Coming to you from the world-renowned Magnum Building on beautiful Payne Avenue in the heart of Cleveland, Ohio, it's the entrepreneur himself, Dan Hansen, bringing you the Great Lakes Geek Show. Okay, today's episode of the Great Lakes Geek is brought to you by Boundless Flight, and it's fitting because Boundless Flight is a member of NEOSA, and we're talking with NEOSA founder and president Jim Cookenham. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Dan. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. Hey, Jim, many of the issues that civic and tech organizations have just recently discovered, you were addressing back in 1998. What was the motivation behind NEOSA back then when you started it?
Well, when I started in 1998 in Cleveland, Ohio, we really looked at the region, and there was a feeling that the tech companies were isolated. They didn't really know that there were other tech companies. They didn't know there was a tech community. There was, Northeast Ohio kind of has an inferiority complex, so everybody felt pretty much there's nothing going on in Northeast Ohio. And so we looked at a few issues that would be of interest to that group, and really focused on that, which at that time was workforce, trying to get money for them, and trying to get them to network amongst themselves, and having the region recognize that there was some pretty cool stuff going on in Northeast Ohio, to everybody's surprise. So those were kind of the founding principles of getting the Northeast Ohio Software Association going.
So how has the mission of NEOSA evolved over the years? It's no longer really the Northeast Ohio Software Association. What's its mission and purpose today?
Well, it's known as NEOSA now, and NEOSA has merged with the Chamber of Commerce, and the mission of NEOSA always has been to grow the information technology industry in Northeast Ohio. That's still the mission of NEOSA. NEOSA now has about 800 technology companies that are members. However, I would say that many things have changed in Northeast Ohio in those more than 7 years since NEOSA was first started. And I think that a lot of the energy around trying to get the community to network, a lot of the energy of trying to get early stage capital for companies, a lot of the energy around we need to do something differently in Northeast Ohio because there's a kind of a new economy out there that we need to be more aware of. I think there are many organizations that have picked up that banner, if you will, and it's not like NEOSA is needed to do some of those things. You know, the number of well-funded organizations that are doing what we were doing by ourselves, you can count them. There are Jumpstart and Nortec and other organizations whose mission is much what we were doing on our own 7 years ago.
You know, I'm always surprised myself, and I'm in the tech world, at how many IT companies are in the region and how pervasive information technology and other technology is in Northeast Ohio. I know some of your research at NEOSA has come up with some numbers there. Do you have any of those you can rattle off?
Yeah, the number that I think was a little shocking to everybody is that when we did the original surveys, and we're looking to probably do another one, right now, but we did this about probably 5 years ago, and we looked at the number of jobs in Northeast Ohio that are IT jobs. And we found that there were about 71,000 IT jobs. That was about 5% of the workforce, and that represented about 10% of the salaries paid in Northeast Ohio were paid to people working in IT. So, a lot of the community, I believe, would say, well, we don't really have any IT in Northeast Ohio, and that's not true. It's, one-tenth of one out of every $10 paid to people is paid for IT reasons. An interesting piece we have in Northeast Ohio that of those 70 plus thousand jobs, 2 out of 3 of those jobs are in traditional companies. So what that means is there are people that are working for Progressive Insurance or KeyBank. Bank or National City Bank. And if you look at the number of IT employees, for example, at Progressive Insurance, they now have 4,000 people in their IT department. You know, that's an enormous development staff there, you know, probably to rival most of the largest software companies in the country. And, you know, so they're different. And if you looked at, if you kind of cataloged the companies in Northeast Ohio by SIC code or by the codes that the government uses, the NAUX codes, you wouldn't see that because Progressive would be shown as an insurance company, and you'd say, well, there aren't any high-tech jobs there, kind of. Well, there are. And so if you really add up all the jobs, you know, there are a lot of jobs in IT. So it's very important to the region, not only for the IT companies that are standalone, but for all those companies that depend upon IT for their survival in this global market.
Yeah, those numbers are pretty amazing. Well, let's go back a few years. Your first exposure to high technology was probably, correct me if I'm wrong, in the Navy. Tell us a little about your stint in the Navy.
Well, I wouldn't say I was exposed to high technology. Actually, I was on a nuclear sub, and nuclear submarines, you know, it's very interesting, but Admiral Rickover, when he designed these, wanted to make sure that there was enough risk with using nuclear power, and so he didn't want to risk anything by using the latest technology. So the submarine I was on was called Sea Dragon. Fast attack submarine. And I was the reactor controls officer when I first went on board, and that was kind of the high tech of the instrumentation and controls because it was controlling the reactor. But, you know, it was all manually controlled. There were no automatic controls because they didn't trust that. They wanted humans to make those decisions. So really, that exposure, I would not call it high tech, although it was nuclear power and nuclear physics, and that was interesting. But, you know, my probably first real exposure was when I was a project manager for Westinghouse, and at that time, Three Mile Island happened. And when it happened, the NRC said, you've got to really change the way you do things. And the first project one of my customers had was to take the inputs from the nuclear plant, which were 19,000 inputs, and put it on one CRT. So there was an octagon if everything was safe. And I was in charge of getting that program done, and most of it was software development, although I didn't know anything about software development. That was my first inkling that I better start learning something about technology, because I could not understand what they were talking about, or you know, when people were trying to blame each other, I couldn't figure out who to blame. So close to that time, the IBM PC came out, and so I bought one. And my wife and I started the first publication ever published on the IBM PC, and it was called International PC Owners, and I think the PC came out in September of 81, and our first issue came out, I believe, in December of 81. And so we reviewed all the new software, all the hardware with it, and, you know, we ended up having about 2,000 members throughout the world, and for 5 years we published that. If you look up International PC Owners in Google, you'll see some of the software that we helped launch and other things. So that was really my first exposure to PC kind of high tech.
I could tell you are a user groupie at heart.
Yeah.
And I know you've come a long way. I know you like listening to audiobooks and podcasts and all on your new iPod Nano.
Right.
But the story of how you got your Nano, the logistics and all, might serve as kind of a wake-up call to some of us in this country.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, let me tell you that story. You know, I was of course, I like all the geeky stuff, and so I was looking at the Wall Street Journal, and I saw that this iPod Nano was announced, and it was a Wednesday afternoon, just a few weeks ago, and so I went to Apple.com. Of course, I already have an iPod, so why would I need another one? But, you know, geeks, you do need the latest. So I went on, and I put in an order for one, you know, a black one with 4 gigabytes, and I wanted my name engraved on the back, and I wanted my phone number engraved on the back, so if I lost it, somebody would call me and tell me to pick it up, of course. And so this was Wednesday at probably 6 o'clock. On Monday at 10 had been manufactured in China and delivered to me. And one of those days, I could see that it sat in Indianapolis, but it went from, you know, China to Alaska to Indianapolis to Cleveland. So I order it the end of the day Wednesday, and it's in my office on Monday morning, and it's customized. That blows my mind. That really,
yeah, that's
it. Just talk about a global market. It's unbelievable. You know, so
that is amazing.
I think it's a great little device. I mean, it does scratch, as you hear people talk about, but boy, what to have something that small. And I was reading something yesterday, and they said they're selling them below price, below their cost. And when you think about, you know, if you got a thumb drive, a gig thumb drive would probably cost you, I don't know, $70 or $80, right?
Yeah, right.
So if you get 4 gigs, that's, you know, $360, and this costs $290.
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredible if you think about that. If you just used it as a little, you know, thumb drive, you'd probably be cheaper than if you went and bought the stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
So before you head off to that desert island, what one book or a record might you put on that Nano?
Well, you know, there's a book I've read recently, listened to recently, on Alexander Hamilton that has really blown my mind. I mean, I'm not a history buff, and I sure don't know anything about early America, the United States, but that particular book by Ron Chernow is unbelievable, and it's actually caused me to read a whole bunch of other books on that subject. It's just, so if anybody gets a chance to read Alexander Hamilton, listen to it. You can get it on audible.com. Another book I really like is The Caine Mutiny, and I've always liked that. So music, I would say the 60s, you know, that's the stuff I like. That's in my heart more than anything else.
It's amazing. I listened to the John Adams book. I think it was David McCullough and some of the stuff from 1776 and how fascinating those times were.
Yeah, I've done the 1776. I've done the John Adams. But this Alexander Hamilton thing just, you know, to me is in a different league even than those books. It's just what an incredible person. I didn't know beans about Alexander Hamilton,
yeah.
But boy. He must have been one smart dude, I'll tell you that. Incredible.
All right, we'll have to check that out.
Yeah.
Another thing that I think you were at the forefront for talking about before anyone else, and it's painful for some of us, you saw in the Economist magazine just announcing that Cleveland and Pittsburgh tied for the most livable cities in the U.S.
Yep.
And for Browns and Steelers fans, it's very tough to share anything with the other city. But you've been pretty open to pointing out our similarities and the opportunities. How are we similar, and what should we be doing to take advantage of these similarities?
Yeah, well, I've always, you know, I when I worked at Westinghouse, I lived in Pittsburgh, and I'm not from either Pittsburgh or Cleveland, but, you know, if it weren't for the football teams, we would probably be really close with Pittsburgh because we're both, you know, old-line manufacturing cities with, you know, a strong heritage of kind of major growth in manufacturing, and we've all had these incredible Fortune 500 companies. Many have left the region since, and I think Pittsburgh probably is in worse shape in that way than we are. And, you know, Pittsburgh, for a number of reasons, in the 80s decided to really do software, and Carnegie Mellon, of course, is extremely strong in software development. So it's always felt to me like the two cities have more in common than most cities. And if you look at Cleveland and Columbus as an example, I would say we've got more in common with Pittsburgh than we do with Columbus. And you know, it just we're only, you know, a couple 3 hours away from each other. And you know, why don't we share these ideas and kind of pull together and. You know, in the world market, we're right next to each other, and it just seems like a lot we could learn from each other. So that's always been one of my great desires, is to try and get the two cities to talk to each other and work together.
that football, I'm telling you.
Yeah, well, I know the guy from the Pittsburgh Technology Council, Steve Zalstra, feels the same way, and we both, he's not from Pittsburgh either, although he has given me some pretty nasty T-shirts around football time. I actually bought him one the other day. I don't know if I have the nerve to send it to him. You know, so it's that nasty of all T-shirts, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of the Pittsburgh Technology Council, you've been the head of CRITA, the Association of Other Organizations like NEOSA. You're an officer there. How do we, Cleveland in particular, in our region, compare with some of the other, I mean, we all know about Silicon Valley and the Research Triangle and all, but in dealing with your peers in CRITA, how are we doing compared to other cities like us?
Well, I think we're doing a heck of a lot better than most of the people in Cleveland would feel. You know, I know that NEOSA was one of the fastest growing in the country in terms of technology associations, and it just seems like there's a lot of energy here. So I don't think there's anything to hang our heads about. If you go wander around North Carolina, I'm sure they've got good pockets of things going on, but this is a great place and great cost of living, the weather could be improved a little bit, but many cities like Minneapolis have worse weather than we're doing, and they're doing great. So I think it's a great place. I don't think we have a problem there, really. I think one of our biggest problems, again, is our own perception of ourselves. If we maybe bragged a little bit more about what a great place this was, you might find a lot of companies wanting to move here.
Yeah, that's I agree 100% with you there. I know you were trying to bust that funk years ago, and
right. Maybe
we're finally breaking through a little.
Yeah, the funk buster.
Yeah. So what are some of the things that NEOSA has coming up? I know the CIO symposium's coming up. Tell us about some of these.
Yeah, well, we're going to pick CIO of the year this year for the first time we've ever done that. And, that's going to be interesting to recognize some of the people in that area. You know, we're going to continue to try and have events that spotlight on cool companies. One of the things we have at the CIO symposium is we're going to highlight some of the cool companies from Northeast Ohio that I'm sure the CIOs are not aware of, some of the neat things going on. And, we'll continue to try and do that. We're going to be doing more things for other segments or other networks within COSY over the next calendar year. And, it's going to be exciting, as always. And try and work with as many of these other organizations as we can.
Let me give you one last question. It's a tough one, as I found out from the number of emails that I got after the recent Inside Business column on who gets it.
Yep.
Who do you think gets it in town?
Well, of course, gets it, the first is what do you mean by that? But without asking you that, in my area where I work with IT and workforce and trying to get, there's one person that gets it in this region in ways that always astounds me, and that's Dr. Roy Church, who is the president of Lorain County Community College. When I hear him talk, I go, like, how does this guy know so much about this stuff? But about IT workers and trying to change the economy, he's got heavy anyway, he just astounds me, and I don't think he could never be given enough credit for how smart he is in the area. But, there are other guys. I mean, Jürgen Faust. I think Kathy Horton's doing some really neat stuff. Len Steinbach and the tech CEOs. I mean, I'm not going to go through all of those guys, but, there are a bunch of them. Another thing, area, too, that I don't think people give credit for is if we are world-class in anything here, or one of the areas, it's in our law firms. We've got some tech lawyers in this area, in this region, that really understand the issues, and sometimes they're not given enough credit. The people at Dan McMullen and Ira Kaplan and John Sada, and I mean these are world-class people that are dealing with world-class tech companies across North America, and they know a lot of stuff, you know. So I don't know. That's kind of my list. You know, with Roy Church being right up there, he's my hero.
Well, be prepared to get a bunch of emails on the people you left off.
I know that. I said the tech CEOs. I mean,
right.
I think they're really the leaders of the pack. And you know, I thought if I started listing them, I'd really get in trouble. But you know, they're the guys that make it happen. And so, you know, all of those guys get it.
All right. Well, thanks, Jim. We've been talking geek to geek with Jim Cookenham, the president and founder of Neosa. Follow the link on this page to visit neosa.org. And we'll be speaking more with Jim in the future on the Great Lakes Geek Show.
Great. Thanks a lot, Dan.
You've been listening to the Great Lakes Geek Show. Come back soon. www.magnuminc.com.